Hello, good morning, and you're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, will Apple tax windfall spent on water quality save the derogation? Not a rusty bucket, addressing opposition to sending Shannon water to Dublin, and the midwife's medical bag present at the birth of the nation. It's a little bit damp out there this morning, but I think if you turn that weather map upside down, squint at it a little bit, you might just be able to eke one last day out of our Indian summer before battening down the hatches tonight. Officials from Brussels were here recently enjoying that lazy, hazy September weather, while also hearing arguments for retaining the derogation that allows some farmers to spread larger amounts of manure than everyone else. All the political parties, the farming organisations and the dairy industry are agreed that losing this derogation would be ruinous. But water quality in many rivers, lakes and estuaries has not improved as much as we promised it would when we got that derogation. So it is a rock and a hard place situation that has left a massive question mark hanging over both dairy farming and nature restoration. So this morning, following that official visit in the last week, we are going to take a look at two things. What way might the Commission be leaning on the derogation, and what impact would it have if it were to go? Food and farming freelance journalist Natasha Foote has spent the week having hushed conversations in corners with officials all over Brussels on behalf of Countrywide. She joins me on the line now. Natasha, there's two things to consider here. The Commission says that it's going to be guided by the science in its decision, but there's obviously an awful lot of politics at play here too. So let's consider the politics first, will we? New commission, new commissioner, new set of political priorities for the commission. How might they favour Ireland getting a new derogation?
Yeah, it's a big question. Absolutely, as you say, Brussels is sat at the start of a new five-year political cycle, and this transition period is always a bit odd. There's always a lot of things up in the air. Definitely a moment of politics rather than policy. But we're starting to see the shape and the tone of the next mandate. We're getting a clearer idea of the flavour of the next 5 years. So firstly, von der Leyen's priorities this time around is really focused on competitiveness. So that's really the name of the game here. While in the last mandate, it was all about the Green Deal, that was really the flagship of the last mandate, that's much less in vogue. It's still there in the background, but it's got a much less prominent role. So already, I think that the framing of the next 5 years going forward, it tells you a lot there.
The phrase that we hear repeatedly now is clean, not green, as being the new tone and tenor of this commission. So in that context, talk to me about the commissioner who, pending their approval by the Parliament, is going to be responsible for the derogation. Jessica Rosswall from Sweden.
Yes, this is a Swedish pick for the commissioner. It's been a bit of a controversial pick, especially from the environmentalist side. The proponents of the Green Deal are a bit concerned here that she might not approach the Green Deal with much enthusiasm, pointing to the Swedish government's track record on the environment. But just important to say, I think there's a few things here that are really important when it comes to this commissioner designate. Number one, to say that she is the EU commissioner, not the Swedish representative. She's not representing Sweden. The national countries always have a little bit of a sway on their commissioner, but she's really there to deliver on von der Leyen's priorities for the commission. I do think it's notable that the new title of the environment commissioner has a specific mention to water. So it's the Commissioner for Environment, Water Resilience and Competitive Circular Economy. I think it's very notable that that was chosen there. And also, as you said, I mean, she still has to jump through the hoops in the Parliament. So she's the commissioner designate. It's not a done deal yet. So all the commissioners are subject to a grilling in the Parliament. I think she'll have a tough time facing the Parliament whenever the hearing
but
comes.
But assuming she does end up getting approved, does it open the door to a political decision being made here, just a little bit wider, rather than one that would be guided solely by the science?
You could say, it's a bit speculative, obviously, it remains to be seen. But I mean, I think you could say that in general, she might be more open to that, given her background.
As we say, if the decision was to be made based on politics alone, the Irish government might be right in thinking that they have a bit of a shout now at retaining the derogation. But the decision is also going to be influenced by the science and the advice of officials, particularly those in Jessica Roswald's directorate, DG Environment. What are you hearing from those officials and from within DG Envy?
Well, it's obviously a politically salient, very sensitive issue. So the commission is keeping quite quiet about this. It's quite difficult to get a peep out of them. But so on the record, I was chasing them all week. The commission didn't comment on this. But I've been talking to a lot of institutional sources, as you said, that told me, you know, that in general, patience is wearing quite thin with the derogation. So one commission source said that that DG Envy seems quite clear cut about wanting to bring the derogation to an end, that many in the environmental side of the commission think there's been enough time for the transition. There's some frustration there. It's also true that you mentioned, you know, there's been a few developments in the past few weeks. This trip to Ireland that you already spoken about, with the commission coming over to Ireland to see the situation there, and also this water quality plan, this new plan from Ireland, basically a bit of a trade-off, a plea deal, if you like, trying to say that if Ireland works on water quality and pumps the resources and investments there, that they might be able to trade that off for an extension of the derogation.
I asked the commission for a statement on this, and specifically DG Envy. It was very, very short. It didn't say very much, but there was one very pointed line in it. The European Commission reiterates the importance of implementing the Nitrates Directive to achieve good water quality status in Ireland by 2027. Do you think that's another way of saying there are rules and Ireland can't keep on expecting to be an exception to them?
I think that is the feel in general. I mean, I think if I had to sum it up, I would say that Ireland's hanging on a bit by its fingertips to the derogation, might just about scrape another few years, but it really hinges on proving that water quality has improved. So I think there has to be some tangible, observable improvement in water quality.
Stay with us, Natasha. I want to hear from somebody at the coalface, because this is, of course, the uncertainty that dairy farmers are operating within. Invest in water quality and the derogation might be lost anyway, losing you a lot of money. Don't invest in water quality and you will almost certainly lose the derogation permanently. Quite the catch-22. Donal Kavanagh is a dairy farmer we've spoken to on Countrywide before. He milks 200 cows on the South Kildare-Wicklow border. Donal has invested hundreds of thousands of euros in decreasing his farm's impact on water quality. But even with that investment, were Ireland to lose the derogation, Donal told me, there would be a major question mark over the viability of the family business.
Enough room up here for the two of us. Oh, there is.
Donal's slurry tank is big. The top of the ladder is 5 metres, 16 feet high. It's 25 metres wide.
500,000 gallons.
As the cows spend the winter indoors, this tank will gradually fill up.
So this gives us great comfort that we can store all the winter storage and make, I suppose, good decisions then when the growth comes back.
A 500,000 gallons of slurry storage here, plus another tank in another yard, means that Donal has, barring an exceptionally long winter, a third more capacity than he should need for his 200 cows, which means he will only have to spread slurry when he is sure that grass is growing and the nitrates will be taken up and not run off into the watercourses.
Last winter, how full was it? Where was it up
full to the brim. We couldn't hold anymore.
But for others to do now to try and save the derogation, what Donal has already done, would be a very big investment in an uncertain future.
This tank, I would say, would cost about 150,000 at the very least, in today's terms.
That's not a decision that you're going to make, is it, if you don't know what the future of the derogation is?
Absolutely not. No. Because it's a big commitment. It'd be very hard to make a decision like that long term.
If, like Donal, your farm is in derogation, you're allowed to spread slurry at 220 kilos of nitrogen per hectare. If Ireland loses the derogation, that figure would drop to 170 kilos, a reduction of nearly a quarter.
A quarter less slurry means a quarter less cows or a lot more land.
What happens if the derogation goes to this business?
For me there, I've two working units, including myself here at the minute, and we work very well. I can get a day off. My workman can get his weekends, I can get weekends. If that derogation went straight away, is it viable for two units anymore? It's very hard to get good labour, and at the moment I have good labour. So all that would be up in the air.
If you had to lose 25% of the herd, that's 50 cows in your case, is this viable any longer?
That would be a big worry to me and the business. Like, do I want my kids, whether it's my daughter or my son, to take on a business that's you have to work 7 days a week? There's an awful lot of young people walking away from the business at the minute, and it's, you know, we're trying to encourage them into it. And this wouldn't be something now that I'd be very worried about the business going forward.
Would it have been better if we'd been having this conversation 5 or 10 years ago, or even at around about the time the quota was lifted?
It's 5 years ago that this problem was there. It was never addressed. Politicians never addressed it. It was a bit like a poison chalice. It's now it's critical, and it's been addressed at the last minute.
As Donald leaves the cows out after morning milking, he reflects that if the derogation goes, he is within 5 to 10 years of retiring, so he will probably push on with less labour, less cows and less profit. But for a younger man, it would be a very different calculation.
I'd be worried about the young person coming in to taking on the business at that place. You know, there's a lot of challenges out there already, and something like this doesn't help.
So let me ask you that as a hypothetical then. If you were 25 or 30 years of age and the derogation goes and you're looking at having to buy another 50 acres of land at 25 or 30 grand an acre, is that a kind of a deal breaker? Does it just not make any sense at that point?
I think you'd have to love the business to stick with it. And for me, I always loved the business, so it was never a problem.
You all love the business and you'd all keep on throwing good money after bad to keep in it, won't you?
Well, sure, you know, we grew up with it. It grew up with it as a way of life. Maybe choices were a bit different that time. There wasn't that much employment and all when I was growing up and all. And it was a good business to be in. Today, there's an awful lot of businesses out there and there's very good opportunities.
Better businesses than this, perhaps?
A lot of opportunities, jobs, lifestyle, everything else. And for rural areas, it's going to be a disaster.
Recently, his farm was used as a demonstration farm for water quality improvements. It gave him an opportunity to talk to a lot of other farmers about how they'd cope if the derogation goes.
We set it up thinking maybe 100, maybe 150 max would come. And over 300 people turned up that day, which was unbelievable.
Okay, that is quite impressive, isn't it? But with the best will in the world, if they all decided to do something tomorrow, they're not going to turn it around in time to save this derogation necessarily, are they?
No, they're not. It's going to take a bit of time. This thing happened over time and it's going to take time to fix it.
And what were they saying, or have they even begun to contemplate the derogation going?
Well, they're very aware of it for their business, because it just changes the whole dynamic of the business. And to add this into the mix as well, it could be the breaker for a lot of people.
Donald Kavanagh there, just outside Bolton Glass. Natasha Foote is still with us. Natasha, you heard Donald saying there diplomatically that it would have been a lot better had the Irish government dealt with this before it became a crisis. As you reverted to briefly there, the Taoiseach's suggested way out of this crisis might be to throw some of the 14 billion euro tax windfall at it. Again, can you give us a little bit more detail on how officials responded to that idea?
Yeah, I mean, there's been no, I don't think there's been an official response to it for the moment. But like I said, I mean, I think that throwing this kind of money towards this is a positive thing, because as I said, I think the only way to hang on to this derogation is if there's some tangible improvements in water quality. I suppose the thing is that has to translate into actual demonstrable water quality improvements. So even if you're putting, big amounts of money on this, advisors throwing everything you've got at it, on the other side, it has to actually translate into something tangible, into water quality improvements in order to hang on to this.
At the outset, I kind of pitched this as a case of politics versus science with one or the other. But would it be unwise to rule out what you seem to be suggesting there, a kind of an artful hybrid combination of the two?
I suppose that's always what you're hoping for, isn't it, in situations like this, some kind of compromise between science and politics. But, as they say in Brussels, a good compromise is one where everyone is unhappy. Let's see how it goes for the future. It is a very politically charged subject, so it's difficult to say where the compromise will lie for the moment.
Natasha Foote in Brussels, thank you very much. Still to come this morning, yet another water project earmarked for the apple tax. A water pipe from the Shannon to Dublin.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
A lot of email and text reaction to that piece. Farming is a business just like any other. Why should it get state support? Says one very unsympathetic person on 51551. Another, a little bit more nuanced. Dear Countrywide, you know well that there's way too much fertiliser and slurry. What does that farmer need 200 cows for? It's greed. But then they go on to say, on the other hand, since farm incomes are not keeping pace with inflation, look at the public sector, it rises a couple of percent per year. You could live on 30 cows 30 years ago. That is the problem. Milk and beef prices are back at 1980 prices. The government loves cheap food and they want farmers to support the country. And that really is the reality of it, isn't it, folks? That no matter how expensive you feel that your food or your grocery shopping has got, we are spending less and less and less of our income year after year on food. Something's got to give at some point. Joe Ribbon is a master craftsman who has spent his life preserving the tradition of the old Irish dresser. He makes new dressers and restores old dressers in Connemara. A cabinet maker by trade, he trained in the Letterfrack Furniture School in the early 80s and has been making dressers for over 25 years. Tracy Vranek dropped in on him to one of his workshops as he was finishing a dresser he had built by commission.
Hi Joe, how are you?
How are you doing?
Not too bad. A little bit lost. I'm at a yellow long house that has the Child of Prague in the window.
You're at a yellow long house. Now, have you any idea who you are at all?
Well,
where are you?
I've gone through Tully Cross. I think I'm in Rainbow. How are you, Joe? Okay, thanks.
That's the kind of thing that we're involved in as such. And, you know, as I say, like, the demand for them might...
Beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. This one, no, this particular one, somebody wanted distressed. They wanted just a little bit of wear on it, just so it looks like it's more used, you know? So, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
they want
yeah.
ages and things taken off them just to make them look a bit more used,
you
know?
Make them look a little bit older.
Well, that's it, you
yeah,
see.
Yeah.
That, you know, they're meant to be kind of, you know, used and passed down through the generations.
Absolutely. Well, the dresser is absolutely gorgeous. It's unusual in that it's a pretty, pretty dresser, isn't it?
Yes, well, the thing about the Irish dressers was, in the old Irish households, they were a private place. Basically, what it meant was that, you know, if a woman had a well-blemished dresser, it meant that the family were doing well and that she had pride of place and that she was happy in the house. So this would be the cornice here, right, which is the top, and that's where all the cups would be hanging on the top. They'd usually be on hooks, right? So this is the front facade here, right? So you'd have different shelves all the way down the dresser for different... like bigger plates, smaller plates or whatever. And then you come down onto the bottom, which is the wider spot here, and that's called the bed of the dresser. So that would be like the modern day worktop, right? And then you have the drawers, right? Usually two drawers. Sometimes there was more. Sometimes there was a drawer here in the middle called a knife and a fork for the middle there. And these are the panel doors then down the front. And that's where they used to store all the crocks of milk and the crocks of water or whatever, and then it's sitting up on the plinth at the bottom.
But they never put anything or hide anything underneath, would they?
No, but believe it or not now, you might believe this, but some of them used to keep the chickens in the bottom, right? Yes, there was dressers that had, they were called dresser coops, right? And the reason for this, very interesting now, right, is that when they get up in the morning, the chickens that have laid, right? And they had slats in them here. Do you see the way these are panels?
Mm-hmm.
So the ones that had the coops in them, they could see the chickens in through, right? So that if a chicken or poultry was warm, they'd lay all year round. So that's why they had them in the house, right? And there was another reason for it, was it used to stop the hens from laying in the thatch and the kids going up, damaging the thatch, looking at the eggs. And another thing it used to stop, apparently, this is all history now,
yeah,
was it used to stop neighbours quarrelling over where their chickens was and who they were around. We don't do chickens in ours.
Tell me, I suppose, the differences nowadays compared to maybe when you started out. If we think of maybe fast furniture and the mass-produced furniture that's out there now, are the type of skills that you have, are they sort of falling by the wayside today, do you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. When we learned, you know, everything had to be cut by hand, everything had to be done by hand first, right? And then we moved on to the power tools and the whatever, you know, the power machinery or whatever. But as the years have rolled on, it's almost impossible. You wouldn't make a living now trying to make this, because everything's so mass-produced now that you just couldn't be able to keep up with it, because there's such a difference in the cost of a handmade item and a mass-production item. So, you know, it's hard to blame people if they see a cheaper unit and a handmade unit. You know, they're always swayed to go for the cheaper item, even though the dresser or whatever item is made by hand would probably last 10 times as long.
Traditional furniture in people's houses these days, are they interested in traditional Irish furniture?
I think actually it's coming back. I do actually think it's coming back. I think things are changing. They will come back into fashion, you know.
You've been making furniture for people's homes for a very long time, and you know, if they mind that dresser, if they mind that piece of furniture, they'll be there in 100 years time,
yes,
or 150
yeah,
years time.
Yeah.
How does that feel to you, knowing that your work is going to be in their kitchen for another generation?
Well, it gives me great satisfaction, to be quite honest, because, you know, I like making stuff like that. It's in my hand. I've done it for years. I don't know anything else. It just gives me great satisfaction, and it's good for a person's mental health to be able to go out and make the likes of that. And I, you know, at some stage I will, it's in my life's work, that I will put something up online. I'm going to actually teach people to make their own dressers, so I will probably be looking at that in the near future, to run some kind of workshops or whatever, and that people will be able to come online and see one being made and make their own.
He should do that and turn social media to something useful, and he should reinstate the idea of being able to put the hen in the bottom drawer as well. The amount of mess they make in the kitchen if they ever get in. Bottom drawer would be the best place for them, wouldn't it? We've already talked about spending the apple tax on water quality this morning, but there's another project being mentioned for that $14 billion. It's the Shannon Pipeline project to pump water from our longest river to Dublin and the other eastern counties. Ishka Éireann has already spent nearly €70 million on preparing its planning application for the project, which could cost as much as €6 billion to complete. However, the plan has once again aroused concerns among some farmers and environmentalists in the Tipperary and Lough Derg areas. So Lorna Siggins has been taking soundings for Countrywide from, among others, Tipperary farmer Liam Minahan on his land in Nye.
We're in Nye, which is townland here in North Tipperary, close to the Shannon. We're looking across here at the Shannon at the Slievochtys in Galway. We're looking at Mylissa in Clare. We're looking at the Arra Mountains in Tipperary. We're looking at Keeper Hill and the Silver Mines Ridge. And we're in a valley here which is the centre of the world. I'm a small dairy farmer here in Tipperary and enjoying life. A beautiful place to live, and Irish Water are proposing taking water from the Shannon, which needs serious scrutiny by independent people. not by engineers, because these engineers seem to be focused on engineering and not on what's good for the locality and what's good for the Shannon.
I'm sure you have relatives in Dublin or the Midlands or friends there who are worried about their water supply into the future.
Yes, and they have good reason to be worried, because they have diabolical water supply system in Dublin. But the issue is not supply, because all of the outages that have happened over the last 5 years, not once has there been a shortage of water being the issue. It's always water ingress, burst pipes, replacement of pipes and improvement of quality of water in Dublin. Not supply so that they can leak it.
Pat Murphy is my name. I'm a senior programme manager with Uisce Éireann. Leakage reduction remains a key priority for Uisce Éireann, but it in itself is not going to address the need that we've identified in the region. We've an ambitious programme to get leakage down to 25% nationally by 2030 and 20% in the Greater Dublin Area by 2030. So by the time this project is delivered, we'll have leakage levels down in the Greater Dublin Area to around 20%, and we've already factored those reductions into our calculations of what we need from the River Shannon.
So farming is tough. Dairy farming is tough.
It is.
And you could get compensation. Is this pipe going to cross your land, or do you know
yes,
yet?
Yes, it is. This pipe is going to cross my land and I could get compensation, that's true. But the reality of the situation is, there's a ring fort over there, and in dry weather you'll see yellow lines where this was dug up 2,000 years ago, and you can see the lines of where the land was interfered with. In 100 years' time, someone will fly a plane over Ireland if this pipe is done. There will be a yellow line all the way from Pertín Weir to Dublin. And my kids will look out there and they will see the way the field is destroyed, and they will say, look what that fool did. He let him take a pipe across the field to Dublin. The money's gone, but the pipe is still there.
A yellow line meaning that it'll
it's impoverished, damaged land. The same as you see in droughts and when you see grass struggling to grow because the land is impoverished.
And I spoke to farmer Liam Minahan, whose land would be on the route, and he says that compensation really won't compensate him for degrading of his land.
Yes, there will be some disruption, inevitably, to landowners, and we'll be trying to keep that to a minimum, and we want to work in partnership with landowners to do that. So we intend, once we acquire the wayleave and once we commence construction, it'll be a case of erecting fencing, stripping the topsoil, stripping the subsoil, and stockpiling them carefully, and then installing the pipeline and reinstating the land. And once it's restored, it'll be handed back to the landowner for normal agricultural activities.
This is illogical. It's not going to happen anyway. Personally, myself, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think politicians in the Midwest will allow our future be sold because engineers want to imply consultants building a pipe that's not needed.
We've examined every water resource zone, we've looked at every option to address the needs in each water resource zone, but really, because of the scale of the deficits that we have at the moment and the projection of increased deficits going into the future and the issues around climate change exacerbating those issues, we really need a major new source, and the only viable option for that is an abstraction from the Lower Shannon. This is the most sustainable solution.
I'm Brendan McGowan, a geography lecturer at the University of Limerick.
We're at O'Brien's Bridge, which is downstream from Pertín, where Uisce Éireann is proposing to extract the water. What impact is it likely to have?
The amount of water that they're talking about abstracting here is 3.8 cubic metres per second. That's 3,800 litres per second. It's not a small amount of water. The plan, Uisce Éireann are saying, that's around 2% of the average flow through there, and that's true, but the concern isn't so much the average, but it's the low points whenever there's drought periods. And the water you can see now is quite high where we are. It wouldn't be a challenge in days like today, perhaps. But, you know, there are going to be drier periods as well. And that's what the challenge is going to be.
The proposed abstraction, I suppose, is an abstraction from Pertín Basin. And the ESB currently manages flows and levels at Pertín Basin as part of their management of the Shannon Hydroelectric Scheme. So they manage water levels quite carefully within a fairly narrow normal operating band. But with this proposed abstraction, there's no proposed change to that normal operating water level range.
So the point of this scheme is for additional water supply to the Dublin area, and it's completely fair to do that in a lot of ways. It also makes sense. The need for this kind of illustrates that planning and development in Ireland over the past few decades has really been focused in the wrong direction. Like, you know, we have had far too much concentration of growth and development in Dublin. And in some ways, this plan is really saying, hey, we need to be doing a lot more regional development and growing Cork and Limerick and Galway and you know, getting things going there so that we don't have to stake everything on bringing water all the way across the country just to supply one major city.
University of Limerick geographer Brendan McGowan, Ishka Aaron's Pat Murphy and farmer Liam Minahan talking there with Lorna. More of your texts. Good morning. As your listener correctly said, yes, farming is a business. However, farmers have to produce top quality food for way below the cost of production, hence the subsidies. No farmers, no good, safe food. And on the dressers that Joe Ribbons was making in Renville, Peter N. in Ranelagh asks, does the dresser have the drawer that the cabin people used to eat the dinner from that could be closed quickly if the visitors arrived? Now, Peter, that joke is almost as old as the dressers. And I think in 2024, it amounts to hate speech. We can't be saying that anymore. And we have been collecting rainwater, says somebody else. Put the money into that and all new houses should have this. Nearly all babies are born in hospital today, but that was not always the case. If you are of a, a certain age, you will have a memory of a woman in a blue overcoat on a bike with a medical bag in her hand, crisscrossing the countryside on her way to deliver babies at home. The role of the community midwife is remembered in what sounds like an absolutely fascinating new exhibition in the National Museum of Ireland and Country Life in Mayo. Its co-curator is Emma Laffey, who has been researching the role of midwives from the 1900s to the modern day. She joins me on the line now. Emma, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Philip. How are you?
I'm great. Take me back, please, to a time before whale song playlists and aromatherapy candles in the birthing room. Set the scene for a home birth 100 years ago.
A home birth 100 years ago was very different to now, but I suppose its predecessor was known as a handy woman. And she was your local community woman that would have came, she would have done the births, the deaths and the sickness. So when she'd come in, she would, the scene I suppose she'd see when she'd come in would be mostly poverty driven. I have Bina Kelly who describes what she sees when she goes in there. This, she said they wouldn't even have sheets on their beds. And if they did, they would be made from flour bags. They would literally have nothing, she said, literally no food, very little food. And her kindness is really what the women were looking for when they were supported in a very vulnerable time, because death was always very prevalent for these women. It was, they knew when they got pregnant that it was a huge risk for them to die.
Where had they gotten their experience or their training from, though, Emma? Because up until before 1918, there was nothing official, was there?
There was nothing official, no. They would have got them from the women before them. It could be an aunt, it could be their mother, their grandmother, whoever that local person was, the women then would in that family would take up the profession. Now, it's very similar to what we have today, but they wouldn't have had, I suppose, you know, cleanliness, or they wouldn't understand infection at that time. And a lot of the women, if they survived the birth, it was the purple sepsis that would have killed them. The cross-contamination that we're all familiar with COVID now, keeping your hands clean and keeping your environment clean. So if they survived the birth, it was another 3 weeks or a month before they really knew whether they had survived it, if you know what I mean.
The handy woman was one name. Unban Glinna was another one. What does that mean?
It means woman of the knee. So when you see women, the midwife going in, they're always on their knees with the birthing during that period, because they would have had birthing stools or they would have been very low on the ground to try and figure out what was going on with the women. Now, and the other side of it is they would have had, well, I suppose you're going into a time where there was no electricity or running water. And Bina again explains that even when during the birthing, during contraction, they would have blown the candle out to spare the candle, because they wouldn't be able to keep the candle even blowing at that time.
Oh, good Lord. How stretched thin were they? Like, how big an area would each community midwife have to cover?
They would have done, I suppose, 10 to 15 miles. some walking. Later on, they would have got supplied with bikes when they were part of the midwifery, the educated midwifery, or if they were afforded a bike. It was a huge area, and they went out all weathers, all times of the day and night. Whenever they were called, they went. And they could be gone. Some of them were family women, and they could be gone from their own families for 2 and 3 nights at times. You know, they would have had to have someone to help them in their own home.
What were the payment arrangements, Emma? I mean, was each family expected to pay what they could, or would they end up working for free a lot?
Well, I suppose a lot of it would be some of it would have been payment with animals and, you know, like chickens or maybe a bit of meat if they had it off the farm. I know later on, say, when the Midwifery Act came in, and they were paid annually by the government, and then whatever the people could afford themselves, like, again, it could be just an animal or a piece of meat or whatever they'd have, you know.
There's one piece of kindness that I'm really struck by, and that's the christening gown that they brought with them.
Yes. So in this exhibition with Mary Ann Fanning, we're highlighting Mary Ann. She really is just the face of all of these community women, because the Fanning family have kept so much memorabilia. And in that is the christening gown. So the christening gown, she made herself, and it was for her own children. And this was in 1902, where her first child was born. And she christened all her own children, her grandchildren, great-grandchildren. And I think there's a great in there, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. But she also used the christening gown for all the local women that she would have helped birth during that period. The women would have been in what they call confinement at that time for a few days after she gave birth. And she would go along with the father or the family member, and they go to the church and christen. And she used to use the christening gown to have all these children baptised.
I mean, I know we pay our taxes and we expect a certain level of services now, and it's only right that we should get them. But it is very useful, isn't it, to remember how not that long ago very different it was, and how many children could expect to die in childbirth, and indeed how many women.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of women. I did a bit of research on it. It was even a year, I think it was 1929, it was nearly up on 8% of the total population of the Mount Bellew Union. The women passed away, but most of it, if not half or more, was the puerperal sepsis, including my own great-grandmother, which really started the journey. I did a bit of genealogy a number of years ago, and family folklore had said she had passed away, a young woman, I think she was 43, Sarah McBride. She was from Raphoe and Donegal. And
how did she die?
She was supposed to be, I'll tell you how what was written on it now. Her little son was still feeding at her breast when she was found passed. So on the little certificate, it said on it, cardiac arrest, maternal exhaustion. That's what really sparked this off for me.
Maternal exhaustion. God, we had really gentle euphemisms, didn't we, for what were probably horrible deaths.
Horrible deaths. Now, there could have been a number of factors there. Maybe she had an underlying condition that wouldn't have been diagnosed in 1930. You know, she'd 7 children. But the reality is poverty was a huge factor in rural Ireland, especially in the West.
And how did that discovery start this journey and this curation of this exhibition for you?
Well, I work in a maternity setting. I'm a HCA in Portiuncla here in Ballinasloe.
Healthcare
and
assistant.
And I see the work... Healthcare assistant, yeah, sorry. And I suppose I see firsthand what these midwives do, which is amazing work, really, day in and day out. But during COVID, I kind of said there must be something in this that for the, you know, for that generator. My great-grandmother was coming in my mind. And I said, I wonder, is there anything written about the older generation of midwives? And I found there was very little. And I love the holistic, the person themselves, what you can find their story, you know, individual story. So I just started going around locally here. I'm a volunteer with the Skehanan District Heritage Group, and we have a great community here, and they're always coming forward to help us with any information we need. And I got a few of the women on board and got some of their stories. And I really progressed from there.
All of which end up in the exhibition. Before I let you go, I want you to tell me, because it is about Mary Ann Fanning, the woman who you're using as the kind of the every woman of midwives. But tell me specifically, please, about the 124-year-old leather midwifery bag.
I will. So Mary Ann bought her first bag in the late 1800s, we think around maybe 1900, and for her midwifery practice. And during 1916, this bag was involved with the Thomas Ashe raid in Ashburn. And she rendered medical aid to the volunteers during this period. So the bag has a really significant role to play for the women that played a role in the 1916 Rising, which we're really only starting to tap into. But this bag is like a brown leather bag, little handle on it, and it's on display with many other items belonging to Mary Ann. Also, her obituary is in it, and it does state that she was in the 1916 Rising, which is great because it's always great to have the black and white to back up the family folklore and the stories. So there's several items there that would be of huge interest to people.
Indeed, present at countless births and the birth of the nation as well. Emma, yes. Thank you very much. Good luck with it. It certainly
You're very welcome.
Sounds like many people should be beating a path now to the NMI Country Life, Turlough Park. It's called Mary Ann Fanning, Remembering Our Community Midwives. Emma Laffey, thank you.
It's open from Friday. Thanks
open
a million.
From for next Friday. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
So to finish this morning, Janet Heeran listens to Countrywide on the family farm in North Cork, where her husband Liam has his dairy business. It might not feel like it today, as I was saying at the start, but September did finally deliver the weather that most farmers, everybody had been hoping for. And for Janet, this was a gift in particular, because she commuted to work from her farm in Bantir through the countryside of Ballycloch to the village of Kildarrery, taking in the changing landscape at this time of year. She was inspired by all of this to put pen to paper and send us her thoughts on summer in September.
I wake to an orange-pink sky. It is obscured by high soft cloud. My neighbour's fields lie muffled beneath the fine white floss. Our house on the north side of Mount Hillary looks down on the gauzy scene like we're in heaven. I drive into the valley. The furze bushes still sport yellow pea flowers linked together by shimmering spider webs, like hundreds of tiny sparkling hammocks glistening in the slowly rising light. By the river, a low sun casts long shadows of chestnut trees across Archdeacon's stubble field. The rays are shards of lemon luminescence piercing the haze. On the road to Mallow, the fog burns off. The tunnel of horse chestnut trees still clings to green. Only the one nearest Rushkeen Bridge is seeding to ragged lemon. The sun radiates a light which sets fire to the brown foliage of the sycamore trees. They were first to turn colour this year. At Ballycloe, the hawthorn hedges are still dripping with mist. Farmers are making the most of the fine late weather. Silage lies in damp rows, waiting for the sun to evaporate the moisture. As my car hugs the hedges at the bends, I meet tractors the size of County Cork. I wonder if the young lads driving are missing the ploughing, or if they already made the pilgrimage to Rathniska over the last 2 days to replenish their supply of grassmen merch. And then, the highlight of my commute, the village of Kildarrery. After the Thatch and Thyme restaurant and Thornhill's pharmacy, the road begins its roller coaster descent into the Golden Vale. Beneath me stretches a quilt of wonder. Grass, silage rows, grain stubble, aftergrass, hedges, ditches, trees, fairy forts, every conceivable shade of green and yellow on nature's colour card. Straw bales sit in the fields like raised stitches on an Aran jumper. Blackberry, moss, honeycomb and diamond. I am tempted to stop, to stand out and breathe in lungfuls of a late summer morning, slightly damp, with a hint of decay and a promise of warmth. But I don't. I would be late for work.
Janet Heron on the last of the summer in September, cherishing the last of that sunshine. One or two more of your texts before I go. A pal who is now 94 years young, is the eldest of 11, all born at home, tells the story of being sent on his bicycle to get the midwife to come to deliver the baby. The father of the baby, who was a farmer, used to pour a drop of whiskey to give to the midwife before the delivery. Not to his wife, to the midwife before the delivery. All 11 babies born safe and well at home, all alive except one who was deceased. My dad clearly remembers his little sister's birth in 1932. The Jubilee nurse came, but his grandmother, who was 85, was the main assistant. They were all told to keep quiet downstairs, but his overriding memory of that day was of the smell of Lysol everywhere. So clearly the midwives and the grandmother knew of the dangers of puerperal sepsis even back then at that stage. That's all we have time for on the last of the summer wine countrywide team. Amandine Paso Devine picked the blackberries, Cara O'Hare gathered the sloes for a pink gin at Christmas, but Brenda Donoghue gave up on autumn and turned on the central heating. Brian Lally is on your way with playback. Have a good weekend. Talk to you next week.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.